Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Halloween is scary and fun, but how did it get started? I'll tell you today. How being scared impacts our body's ability to handle food. Plus, why the obsession with vampires who want to drink your blood? And something scary that's in the food supply, melamine. What it is and how it got there. But first, let's see what's in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Peter Shaner is a farmer who's been coming here to the Wednesday Market for years and years and years. His kids have grown up here. And Peter, it's fall. We're looking at the new crops on the tables. And you happen to have lots of these wonderful pomegranates.
Okay, first of all, the variety is wonderful.
That was a very smart marketing technique.
And they grow very good in our arid, waterless environment.
They got a very, very hard, leathery husk. Now, I've heard you can peel them by putting them in a bowl of water so they don't stain. Do you cut them? Do you tear them apart? How do you open them?
The best way is to tear them apart. You could score the outside edge and then crack it open, break it apart with your hand. And you'll minimize the staining. When the seeds crush, they'll stain you. If you do it all in a bowl of water, the seeds will go to the bottom and all the membrane will come to the top. And that's a real easy and safe way of cleaning them.
Okay, and then they have that little pith in the middle when you're chewing up these pomegranate seeds.
That's the seed. Some people spit them out. It's good roughage. Just chew it up and swallow it.
Okay. And they're so delicious and they're so flavorful. How is a customer going to tell if it's a pomegranate ready to go?
Well, the best way to be assured of a good pomegranate is if the outside skin is starting to crack open.
Okay.
Some of it might be totally cracked open and it'll expose the seeds. Otherwise, they'll just have a slight scratch or scar. The seeds in the pomegranate are swelling with juice and popping the skin. That's what's happening on the inside. That's why its fruit is exploding.
Oh, yum.
It's a good indication that the fruit is of good quality.
This is Peter Shaner, and he's a farmer here, comes to the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. He grows down in Valley Center, down in San Diego, and has these wonderful fall pomegranates for us to enjoy. Amelia Saltzman, who is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook and a longtime friend here at the market, is at the market today. So, Amelia, what are you looking for and what are you going to be making?
Well, it's apple time. Did you know there are 4,000 varieties of apples in this world?
No, I did not.
Yeah, so if you've got 20, 30, 40 to choose from right here, it's a pretty great day.
So you're baking?
Oh, yeah. You know, one of my most favorite things to do with apples this time of year is to make a crisp. It couldn't be simpler. You know, you get 4 or 5 pounds of apples, and what I like to do is use a mix. I love to use some, like, the sweet melting flesh type apples and some tart apples that hold their shape when they're baked. So I just peel the apples, and a really fast way of coring an apple and quartering at the same time is peel the apple, cut it in half, top to bottom, set it down, cut it in quarters, and then just take your knife and just cut that core, that angle, right out.
Okay.
So quarter the apples, throw them in a baking dish, and here's the thing. I like to just add to the apples just a little bit of honey, maybe a tablespoon or two, and either a little lemon juice, or you could use a little dessert wine or a little Calvados, something that goes with apples, but I'm not going to add any other flavorings,
no
thickeners,
cinnamon, no nothing like
not
that.
Not to the apples, because I want the fruit to taste like the fruit. The lemon juice or the liquid that you add is just enough to sort of prime the apples into doing their thing. Then I make a really simple topping, and around this time of year, I love to add cornmeal and ginger to the topping. You can use fresh ginger, or what's nice is is crystallized ginger that you chop, maybe a couple of tablespoons. So what you get are these little wonderful bursts of spice in your topping. So I just take a bowl, put a little flour, maybe a cup of flour, maybe, I don't know, a half a cup or two-thirds of a cup of cornmeal, just plain old cornmeal, a little light brown sugar, white sugar, and the ginger. and maybe a stick of butter that you've cut up into pieces. Just work it with your fingers until you have these little clumps and bumps. Then scatter it over the fruit, put it in a 400-degree oven, and let it go for about an hour.
Such a great way to experiment with all these apples. Then you can nibble on the core and actually taste the apple by itself before you cook it off. All right, Amelia, so tasty, and the apples are so gorgeous right now.
It's
worth
just,
celebrating.
It's perfect now.
It is. All right. Well, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman, and she, of course, is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. When she's in town, she's here at the market every week shopping and getting inspired and inspiring us, too. Be sure to join us next Wednesday, October 22nd, when Mark Peel from Campanile will be demonstrating grilled cheese sandwiches in our market restaurant tent, which is located at 3rd in Arizona. And Mark and his minions will be out there grilling between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That delicious apple crisp recipe is online now at kcrw.com/goodfood. Today, people are biking through Los Angeles while tasting the best of the Mexican popsicles known as paletas. The ride started just a few minutes ago at 11 a.m. and is taking place in Maywood. Find out about upcoming fun food and bike rides like this from the Los Angeles Bicycle Coalition. Go to la-bike.org or go to kcrw.com/goodfood for the link. Lots of things are scary in this world. Real life gets me every time. And what freaks me out is this whole Chinese baby formula scandal. First it was pet food, now babies. The culprit, melamine. What is this stuff and how did it get into the food supply? I find out next. That's coming right up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Melamine, this strange word that many of us associate with non-breakable tableware, has come to enter our mind as this secret toxic ingredient. We hear it a lot in relationship to food recalls and terrible food scandals occurring in China. I decided that the best person to speak to about melamine would be Marion Nessel. Her book, What to Eat, and now her Pet Food Politics, are guides for those of us who really like to know what we're eating and what we're feeding our pets. Hi, Marion.
Hi. Glad to be back.
Oh, I'm so happy to talk to you about this because it just seems like we first started hearing about melamine during the huge pet food recall, and now once again we're hearing about it in relationship to this huge dairy scandal in China where tens of thousands of babies are ill and dying. So I wanted to ask you first, describe what melamine is and how it ends up in the food supply.
Well, it's a very small molecule. It's a chemical that happens to have a very symmetrical structure so that it will polymerize and join with other like molecules when in the presence of a catalyst to form hard plastic. And it makes melamine dinnerware, just as you mentioned. It also happens to be extremely high in nitrogen. And nitrogen is relatively scarce in the food supply. It's found mostly in protein. And it turns out that the test for protein in foods doesn't really look at protein itself. It looks at nitrogen and then does some calculations to kind of convert nitrogen to protein. And so if you put melamine into something that's supposed to have protein in it, it will test as if it has protein in it, whether it does or not. And it has been used as an adulterant of animal feed, now pet food, and now these other things for, as far as I can tell, at least 40 or 50 years. I've got papers going back at least 40 or 50 years talking about the use of melamine as a deliberate adulterant of animal feed to make it look as if it has more protein in it than it does.
So these papers you're talking about were back in the 60s, correct?
Yeah, in the 60s and early 70s. In the 1960s, veterinary investigators wanted to find out if this nitrogen could be used by ruminant animals, cows and sheep that have rumens, to convert that nitrogen into protein because it would be a really cheap source of nitrogen. And so they tried it, and it killed the sheep. So that one didn't work. And then just a few years later, investigators in Italy had this compound melamine that they were using, and they developed a test for it because it was such a common adulterant to fish feed that when they tested fish feed, they found that nearly 60% of the samples were contaminated with melamine. So this is old stuff.
I mean, but you would think that the second that this compound that's meant for creating plastic would be ordered by a company that produces food of any kind, whether for animals or for humans, that some alarm bell should go off.
You would think that somebody would say, what are you using that for? Because there would be only one reason to be using it, and that would be for fraudulent purposes. But we're talking about China here. And I don't mean to be xenophobic about China, because I think what's happening in China is no different than what is happening in any country that's in early stages of capitalist development. In fact, what's going on in China now is absolutely reminiscent of what went on in the United States. In the 1800s in New York, there were all these scandals about diluted milk, and people were diluting milk in order to, you know, they were diluting it with plaster of Paris, they were diluting it with chalk, they were diluting it with anything they could in order to increase the volume without increasing the actual material, because they were making money that way. And what stopped that kind of thing in the United States were the Food and Drug Laws of 1906. Once we had those laws in place, we were able to enforce food safety regulations, and things improved a lot. And China doesn't have those laws. And it has a food supply that is largely made. 80% of the food in China is produced by little backyard operations, millions of them.
So it's incredibly fragmented as opposed to our food supply, which is extremely integrated.
Right. And so for a central government to try to get control of a food supply that is done in this extremely fragmented way over a very large country with an enormous population is really difficult. And the Chinese promised after the pet food recall that they were going to clean up their act. But they've not been able to do it, clearly.
So talk to me a little bit about what's going on now with baby formula in China.
Well, melamine, again, exactly the same compound that ended up in pet food, which I thought should have been an enormous warning. Melamine was put into infant formula in order to make the infant formula look like it had as much protein in it as it was supposed to. And so this was diluted infant formula. It didn't have the nutrients or the protein that infants were supposed to be getting. And because China's society is changing rapidly, there's much less breastfeeding than there used to be. There are lots more people using infant formula, and poor women buy inexpensive infant formula. They don't buy the expensive kind. And the last figure I saw was that it was more than 90,000 infants had been affected by this. And these are kids who are getting crystals in their kidneys that could cause permanent kidney destruction. That's going to be a big mess to clean up. I should say that melamine by itself is not very toxic in low doses, but melamine itself breaks down and comes from the same melamine scrap source as one of its breakdown products, cyanuric acid. And when these two compounds are mixed together, they form crystals at very, very low doses.
Is melamine ever naturally occurring?
No, it's a completely synthetic compound. It's an industrial chemical designed for industrial purposes. It should not be in the food supply at all, zero. And if it's there, it's there for only one reason, and that's fraud.
Talk to me a little bit about the FDA and regulation. We're about to have a new administration. If you could say anything to them about what you would like to see in terms of increased oversight of our food, what would it be?
Well, I completely agree with the Government Accountability Office, which for at least 20 years has been arguing that the only way to ensure food safety in the United States is to have a separate food safety agency with the job of oversight of the food supply from farm to table. We don't have that now. We have a very fragmented system between two agencies, the USDA and FDA, with many, many problems with coordination. Without that, we will continue to have the kinds of problems that we've been experiencing. And until we have a food safety system that requires standard food safety procedures from farm to table, which we know perfectly well how to do, we're going to continue to have these problems.
You are so terrific to talk to. Thank you, Marion.
My pleasure.
Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine is Marion Nessel's latest book. She's a highly respected professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. Does the idea of being locked in a room with stinky cheese make you want to run screaming? Well, not to me. In fact, as we get older, we tend to accept that things that smell bad could quite possibly taste good. When Good Food returns, I'll let you know why some cheese stinks and why that's not such a bad thing. That's coming up in a minute on KCRW and KCRW.com. We've talked about cheese a lot on Good Food, but one aspect of the product we've never touched on is the smell. Stinky cheese. Where does it come from? Why does it smell? Andrew Steiner of Andrew's Cheese Shop in Santa Monica has a passion for cheese, the smellier the better. So we've invited him here today to tell us some little-known truths about cheese. What are some of the stinkiest cheeses?
Well, the most famous of the stinky cheese is one that I brought with me today called Epoisse. And this is from northern Burgundy, close to Chablis. And it's famous for the washing of the rind, which is what makes them stink. And we'll get into that in a minute. But anyway, this one is washed in a Marc de Bourgogne, which is basically a grappa distilled from the grape skins in the fermentation tank when they make Burgundy wine. And basically, that's what gives it this orange color and this very, very putrid aroma.
Putrid aroma. It's funny because I think if you ask people about cheese, people who are really into cheese, who like keep life lists of cheese, mm-hmm. Epoisse will be... They're up there, like it's the number one or two.
One of my most requested cheeses, that's for sure. And some people are under the impression that when you smell a little bit of ammonia in a cheese like this, which you probably smell right now. Do you want to smell the Epoisse?
Oh, here? Sure. I would love to smell the Epoisse.
And keep in mind, this is the mildest of the ones that I have today.
Wow. It's like the ammonia of a Camembert times a lot.
That's right. Well, Camembert, where they get this smell from is a bacteria. The bacteria's name is Brevibacterium linens. And these cheeses were originally made by Trappist monks in the northeast corner of France and southern Belgium, very cold climate. And these monks were vegetarian. And they would work outside in very cold weather. And they wanted to eat something that would be very warming. So they created something that would smell and taste like meat. And this is what they came up with. They started washing the rinds of these cheeses in something with acidity or alcohol or something like that, and you would get these very strong flavors. A lot of people will think cheeses like this smell like feet or body odor or something like that. Brevibacterium linens in nature occurs on human skin. So basically what's happening is if you create a really nice little microclimate environment for this cheese to harbor this bacteria, it starts sucking it up out of the air. And that bacteria, it helps to protect the cheese from some of the bad bacteria that can get in there and create some off flavors. And it helps it to ripen properly from the outside to the in.
I love it. So it's sort of an act of cannibalism
to
eat this cheese.
Right.
So although the monks were vegetarian, they were still ingesting a part of themselves.
That's true. That's true. Exactly right. Yeah.
You got to love that.
So I always tell people the very thing that makes you smell when you don't shower is the same thing that makes the cheese smell when it does shower. But the apois, just so you know, most of the time its bark is much worse than its bite. It's a very, very strong smell, but the flavor, I think it's really sexy. It's very, very gooey and smooth and unctuous with a real lingering finish, a little bit salty. It's just a beautiful, beautiful classic cheese, really elegant.
Cow's milk.
Yeah, apois is cow's milk, yeah. Most of the washed rind cheeses are cow's milk, but they don't have to be.
Okay, so what are the other cheeses you brought with
you? We have some other fantastic ones. One of my favorites is the one that we have right next to the apois, which is going to smell a little bit stronger. You know, some people refer to that aroma as like barnyard.
Oh, I love this.
This is a beautiful, beautiful cheese, really small production. It's made by a very small family in Toggenburg in eastern Switzerland, right near
Liechtenstein. It's almost tobacco-y.
Yeah, definitely. It's very rustic, very earthy. This is actually a version of another famous cheese called Appenzell, and the Krumenzwieler is just a little bit more ramped up than Appenzell. If you like a Swiss flavor, but you want some power and some stink, that's the one, Krumenzwieler. And actually, believe it or not, the recipe that they use to wash the rind of this particular cheese is a very closely guarded secret. It's a mixture of some white wine and herbs and some other kinds of alcohol that nobody's really sure of. But Appenzell also is a secret recipe for the cheese.
And the third cheese you brought?
Roccolo. This is really, really fascinating. Roccolo is from Lombardy in north central Italy. And Roccolo is very gently washed in salt water, but it's aged in an extremely humid environment on wooden planks. And there's a lot of mold and bacteria swarming around this cave. So the smell is extremely powerful, probably the strongest of the three that I have there. And just so you know, like I was talking about before.
Whoa, really? Ammonia?
Really? Kitty litter. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yum. Now, if you were going to give somebody an intro to stinky cheese, somebody who was ready to make the leap, what would you suggest?
I definitely suggest that you don't start off with stuff like this. There's a very fun cheese from Petaluma, California called Red Hawk, made by two really nice women.
Well, it's won tons of awards.
Yeah, they won, I think, in 2003 Best in Show at the American Cheese Championship. And Red Hawk is it's a little complicated. It's what we call a washed rind triple cream. All you need to know about that, what that means, is it's a smelly cheese, but it's also very, very buttery and decadent. That's a great intro into stuff like this, because you get a little bit of that hint of smelliness just to see if you like it. But overwhelmingly, the cheese is very smooth, not salty at all, really rich and buttery. I'd also recommend something like the apois, but I would definitely ask your cheesemonger to give you a really young one. I like them old and vicious with some attitude, but, you know, they get released at 60 days old to the United States, and at that age, they're pretty mild overall.
Andrew Steiner's the owner of the newly opened Andrew's Cheese Shop on Montana and Santa Monica. Descriptions of the cheeses we talked about are at kcrw.com/goodfood. I hate to admit this, but when I see pictures of the Great Depression and hear stories of food lines, I start looking around at what I can harvest from my surroundings. My next guest does that for a living in Central Park. I'll be right back with a tour of what you can eat out of the flora and fauna. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Did you ever find yourself feeling a little peckish while you're out and about? You really wish you'd brought a snack. If only Dr. Nat Bletter were there as your guide. He's an ethnobotanist and a man who could find something to eat just about anywhere. Nat has led people on edible tours of Central Park in New York City, and he's here to tell us about his adventures grazing the world from lava flows in Hawaii to fruit hunting safaris in Malaysia. It must be very surprising to people who go with you on foraging tours just how many plants around them are edible.
Yeah, that's really why I got into ethnobotany, because I was hearing from people that they had misconceptions about where food came from or what it should look like coming from the farm. So they thought that pistachios were naturally red or that figs were only the things found in the middle of Fig Newtons rather than the delicious fresh fruit that you can get straight off the tree, which is one of my favorite subtropical fruits in the world.
How long have you been foraging like this?
I'd say it's going on about 18 years now, actually. Started when I was going to college in Northern California, and I started learning some of the edible fruit trees that were growing around the campus, like loquats and kumquats and citrus and pomegranate and pink peppercorns. And I just went from there, started getting foraging books and going out on my lunch hour while working in Silicon Valley and identifying all the fruit.
Is that how you learned what was safe to eat and what you should avoid?
Yeah. Whenever I found something in the wild, I'd make sure I'd identified it exactly correctly. And the only time I actually got into trouble was when I was doing something I call freezer diving, where I would find random frozen fruit in the back of the Latino grocery stores. And I got a cashew apple, which is the fruit that grows above the cashew nut, which is delicious. It tastes a little bit like mango, to which it's related. But also it's related to poison ivy. And I ate the nut that was hanging right there. I was like, oh, there's the cashew nut. I'll try that. It must be great fresh, not knowing that you cannot eat a cashew raw. It's like eating poison ivy straight. So my lips blistered up immediately, and I was in trouble for a couple weeks after that.
So when we see raw cashews, what are we seeing?
They're just less cooked than than the roasted ones. Yeah, that's a big misnomer. And sometimes when I go into the local food co-op near me, I correct it when it says raw cashews so that the raw foodists don't go astray.
So these days in New York City, where do you go? Where do you take people?
I do most of my tours in Central Park just because I know it really well. I grew up near it. I've also done Prospect Park and actually East River Park, which is right across the street from my house. So, you know, that's my supermarket. If I'm feeling peckish and I need some greens or some burdock root instead of going to the health food store where it's, you know, $6 to $8 a pound, I just go across the street and harvest it out of the ground.
If people see you struggling with a root and some tool to try and rip it out, do they try and stop you?
Sometimes the park rangers have come up to me, but I've explained to them, oh, this is actually a really invasive plant. And, you know, probably all your coworkers are spending all their time getting rid of this, so I'm helping you. In the end, sometimes when they do that, they'll say, oh, well, actually, there's another one over there, and there's a mulberry tree down this road if you want to get some of those. So
there are mulberry trees in Central Park?
Oh, yes. It's loaded mulberry trees and Juneberries, which are so delicious. And
what are Juneberries?
Juneberries taste like a cross of a raspberry and an apple is the best way to describe it, but they look like a blueberry. And they're sprouting up in parks all over the city because they're a native to this area, actually most of the United States, and so they're trying to use more native plants. And in June, as their name implies, they're loaded with these delicious fruit that you can just shake the tree and get a gallon off of pretty easily.
Now, you don't just do this in New York. You've traveled the world in search of what many of us would consider exotic fruits. What are some of the places you've gone, and what were some of your favorite finds?
Probably at the top of my list was finding a wild relative of the mangosteen in Laos. And it's pretty indescribable. Sometimes I say it tastes like lemon pound cake, but better than any lemon pound cake you could ever imagine, or a cross of a peach and a pineapple. The problem is you can't grow it anywhere near the U.S. because it's super tropical. If it goes below something like 50 degrees, the plant will die. And so we want to be able to breed in new characteristics to this plant. To do that, we need to find the wild relatives of the mangosteen, which isn't really well known. And so when I was walking around in a national forest in Laos, I found what looked like an orange mangosteen, and I opened it up and ate it, and it was delicious, and possibly it's the wild relative that we've been looking for.
So how many varieties of fruits have you eaten?
I was just looking at my list, and it's up to 207 fruit species that I've tried. I'm not even counting different varieties of apples, for instance.
That was Nat Bletter. He is an urban forager, and he also forages the world for exotic fruits. He has a PhD in ethnobotany, and we'll have a link to his site at our site, kcrw.com/goodfood. Vampires aren't real. At least, I don't think so. Truthfully, you'd never know it, since we're obsessed with vampires. The food angles are numerous, too. Like, where did garlic as a vampire repellent come from? And what about that blood-drinking thing? I'll be right back with the man who got bit by the vampire obsession and ended up becoming intimate with blood. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Okay, I'll admit it. I read the Anne Rice vampire books. I'm now TiVoing True Blood, and I recently downloaded Twilight Volumes 1 and 2 onto my Kindle. Vampire lore is fascinating, and I'm obviously not alone in my fascination. Eric Newsom, a regular guy who works for NPR, decided to drink his own blood during the course of his quest to encounter the dark bloodsuckers. His book, The Dead Travel Fast, is wonderful, interesting, and very funny. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Why do you think that psychologically we're so attracted to this idea of the undead?
I think it's because it's the perfect metaphor. It is a way that people can discuss things, you know, that they're scared of, or they lust after, or they fear. And they can do it in a way that doesn't really expose them very much. They can kind of express these feelings through this monster.
Okay, so now I guess is the part of the conversation where we have to talk about drinking blood.
I thought you were just going to talk about drinking. Great, let's talk about drinking. There's a lot of that in the book, too.
I would imagine that after you drank your own blood, you really wanted a stiff drink.
No, I didn't want really anything. I didn't want to be alive. I didn't want to breathe. I didn't want to do anything.
How did the decision come about?
I kept coming back to stories where blood is the kind of center focus of a vampire's power. The thing that turns them into a vampire is consuming blood. The thing that gives them their power or allows them to maintain this power is the consumption of blood of the innocent. And I kept wondering to myself, where does this come from? Because in all folk tales, there's always a kernel of truth inside of the tale, where it comes from and where it gets kind of moral base. And I thought to myself, what if there is something to this blood drinking stuff, that maybe it's even like drinking a Red Bull or something, where if you just drink it, it'll kind of give you like a little zezz for a little bit, you know, and you're just kind of like, you know, a little shaky or something. Even if that were to happen, that would show that there's at least something in this that is based in truth. And eventually I decided, you know what, I'm just going to have to do it. So I thought that since anyone who would give me blood is probably not someone whose blood I should be drinking, that I'd have to get it from a source that I trusted. And I thought about how I would ask someone to give me blood and immediately decided that, no, I think the only source of this blood is going to be me.
Okay, so now we're talking about drinking blood. Now, drinking to me is very different than sucking a little cut on your finger
or
taking a little sip. I mean, it implies at least one full healthy gulp.
Right, which I interpreted to be the ultimate measure of a healthy gulp, which is a shot.
Did you just open a vein?
Kind of. Not the way you're thinking. I was right at that time changing jobs before I came here to NPR and was going to a couple final like visits to doctors and stuff like that. And my family doctor wanted to take a blood sample, you know, for cholesterol and all triglycerides and all the nonsense they check for. And so my initial idea going into the doctor would be that I would explain to him that I was doing this research and ask him to just draw an extra vial of blood. And I did that.
The look on his face?
Just at first, he kind of was looking at me like I need more information, and as I often do in that situation, I just keep talking, and I kept talking about research and vampires and wanted to know if there's any truth to it, and didn't want anybody else's blood. And then he looked at me and he said, "Like Billy Bob," and he meant like Billy Bob Thornton and Angelina Jolie when they were married, they had vials of each other's blood around their necks, and I said, "Yeah, if that works for you." That's what I want. I want what they have. And he just looked at me just totally blank and said, no. And then he packed up and walked out of the room. And now I figure I'm in really bad shape. And I look over and on the cart next to me is a box of syringes and a box of alcohol tablets and a box of vials and all the different supplies. And I had my little bag there, so I just stole one of every one and put it in my bag and took it home. I just watched him do it. So I just picked a spot of 3/4 of an inch down from where he did it, and I did the exact same thing.
Oh, my God.
And I had two real fears. My first fear was that I wouldn't find a vein. The other fear I had is that once I started to blood flow, I wouldn't know how to stop it. And so I thought, you know, if I think about this for another minute, I'm not going to do it. And so I just did it.
And then did you empty the syringe into a shot glass immediately?
No, not immediately. I had read, this is so terrible. I apologize. This story just keeps getting worse and worse. I decided that I would follow advice I had read in several online forums, which said that blood is much tastier when it's chilled. So I took a cocktail shaker.
But doesn't it start to coagulate?
No. Not, hey, we're talking from the time this thing left my arm until I had drank it. It was probably 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I put this into a cocktail shaker full of ice, which is that cocktail shaker is still in use in my house today. And I strained it into a shot glass and I looked at it and again said, if I think about this for a second, I'm not going to do it. And I did it. Just back it went.
And how long did it stay in your body?
Maybe 30 seconds.
Did it take the same route out as it went in?
Yep. And it was because people often ask what the blood tasted like. And I, you know, at first it tasted like ice because it was so cold. And then it really tasted like I just licked a railroad tie or something, very irony. And then I could, right about that point, it's like coming to where my collarbone is because I can feel it because it's cold. And then I can feel my stomach starting to rumble. And then it started to taste like, you know, I am an idiot. And then it met my breakfast on the way up.
Thank you so much for being such an unusual...
Idiot?
I wouldn't have used the word. An unusual fellow and written a very entertaining book.
Sure.
That was Eric Newsom. His book is The Dead Travel Fast. And it comes with its own little package that's a vampire repelling kit. Perfect for Halloween. As I mentioned earlier, real life is much scarier than any vampire tale. And when it comes to food, nobody dives into scary edibles more than Good Food frequent guest Eddie Lin. I'll be back to sample some scary sausages. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm here to tell you that there is a sausage fest in Sherman Oaks. And with us to explore this in depth is Eddie Lin, our pal from Deep End Dining. Eddie tends to take a look at food from the more edgy, bizarre, and adventurous mode.
That's right.
But sausages aren't so adventurous, unless there's strange things stuffed in them.
Strange sausages, weird wieners.
Weird wieners? Okay, well, tell me a little bit about the Bratz Brothers first.
Oh, Bratz Brothers is really interesting. It kind of fits in this stretch of Ventura Boulevard in Sherman Oaks. It's a quirky little block. There's like this Shaolin Temple martial arts place across the street, and then there's a psychic eye, you know, bookshop nearby.
You gotta love those.
It's great. And so this little tiny Bavarian, tiny village-looking sausage shop pops up. And it's actually a restaurant. It's not just – they don't sell, you know, frozen sausages or whatever cold sausages. They actually serve them, and that's all they do. But what got my attention was what I call the wild side of their menu. What I had there that particular day was what they call the Wild West, and that's a buffalo and burgundy sausage. The Wild West sausage is marinated in burgundy wine for quite a long time, because when you bite into this thing, I mean, you can totally taste this nice wine flavor.
And how are they served? Are they served on any special kind of bready vehicle?
Yes, actually, the bready vehicle is this custom-made baguette, but it's kind of a mini baguette that perfectly fits the length of the sausage.
So is it a little hard?
It is. It's a little hard and crunchy, you know, just like a regular baguette, but nice and soft on the inside, you know.
Well, for me, buffalo isn't that sort of taking a walk on the wild side. So what can you throw at me that seems a little more extreme?
Okay, let's go down under, shall we?
Sure.
To the land of the ostrich. And oh, by the way, that's what is ground up and served in the sausage. But what's interesting is, ostrich. You know, I've never had ostrich. I thought, okay, you know, if I had a guess, it would be like chicken, but really big. And
It's very lean, ostrich.
Yes, I was wrong. In fact, the meat is red. So it's more like beef. And according to my friend Peter, it's more like horse. I've never had horse.
That's really interesting. Is it kind of sweet like horse?
Yes, actually. There's a little tiny sweetness to it, definitely. And it's very lean. The butcher puts in little bits of crushed pistachio nuts.
Ooh.
Which I thought was really interesting. What made it nice was the hot and sweet mustard.
Yeah, so I understand that they have like a nice little condiment section.
There's all kinds of little quirky touches at the Bratz Brothers. He makes custom ketchup, his own custom ketchup, and there are two of them. One is the curry ketchup, which apparently is something that's pretty common in Germany. And then there's this smoked ketchup, which it tastes a lot like a barbecue sauce.
Were there any other sausages besides the buffalo red wine and the ostrich?
Yes, absolutely. The recent addition is the Swamp Thing, which is a smoked alligator. And I was really excited about that, but it's a bit dry. What I really liked also was the Cajun, which is a wild boar andouille.
That
was nice. You know, there was a little bit of gaminess.
It seems a shame that they don't sell the sausages to go, you know, for people to take home and cook themselves.
You know, from speaking with him, I think he may offer that. It's just that they're made in such small batches
right now since
they just started that they're not really sure of what quantities to make yet. You know, the one I really have to rave about is the New Zealander. It's the spicy lamb sausage. You know, lamb isn't some strange thing to me either. But man, this was just plain marvelous. You know, it's very succulent. It when you bite into it, it spurts. I mean, it was one of those great.
So, do they use natural casings?
Yes, natural casings. And the lamb is actually from New Zealand. It's this really high quality lamb that's not as gamey as, you know, a lot of other lambs you can get. It's a little spicy. You don't even need any, you know, mustards or, you know, fancy custom ketchup. It's just a wonderful sausage.
And are there any sort of condiments or side dishes or coleslaws or salads that they make that you really like?
Yeah, he does slaw. He does cabbage, the red cabbage, you know, grilled onions, things like that.
Do they do sauerkraut?
Yes, they do sauerkraut.
Tell us once again where it is.
It's located in Sherman Oaks at 13456 and a half Ventura Boulevard. I told you it was small. In Sherman Oaks.
And this is Bratz Brothers.
Bratz Brothers Gourmet Sausage Grill.
Oh, that's fantastic. I have to say I really love that someone who's had brains and penis and all this other weird stuff has never had ostrich and buffalo. That just is really great. I love that. Eddie Lin is the Deep End Diner. Find pictures and links to Eddie's escapades at kcrw.com/goodfood. Halloween aside, there are plenty of things that can scare us. The financial situation is one of those. So how does this kind of fear affect the way we eat food? I'll let you know. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Halloween is just around the corner, and it's not all candy and pumpkins. Many people want that jolt of Halloween fear. But just how healthy is it? What does fear do to our bodies, and specifically to our digestion? Jill Jane is a nutritionist who's here today to give us some gory details. How gory does it get? What happens to our bodies when we're afraid?
Well, I think the best way to start is to sort of explain what this fight or flight response is all about. It's actually part of our sympathetic nervous system, which you can remember sympathetic as it has no sympathy. Your body responds immediately to defend yourself from this incoming stress. And the problem is your body doesn't really know the difference between something that's real or that you've sort of contrived at Halloween. Your body reacts, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure goes up, your breathing rate goes up. I mean, I'm sure you can identify being in a fun house, but it can also cause you to vomit or poop your pants. These are serious things that your body is doing to be able to get away from the stress. And during Halloween, usually it's not real. But the problem is, over time, when we experience all this stress, such as work-related stress, it actually has a really bad impact on our body. This is a big reason why we have such a high incidence of cancer and heart disease in our country.
When we're experiencing things much like we are now, with Wall Street happening, the economy in such great flux, people being afraid that they might lose their job, that life as they know it might change in a very dramatic way, do we start to internalize all this as a flight or fight response?
Absolutely. The fight or flight response was built actually for short term. So there is a blog post online called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And the idea is that animals are getting away from the cheetah or the lion, just a short term thing, and they go back to this resting state. Whereas we in this financial crisis, or you could name any event in your life that's stressful, from your mother-in-law to your school assignment to an exam, we our stress now is more long term. So we're in this fight or flight response constantly. So our blood is constantly filled with these with stress hormones like cortisol and norepinephrine that are sort of banging on our blood vessels and causing this stress to organs inside our body. Whereas we tend to think of stress as being, you know, our boss yelling at us or the financial crisis. Our body actually responds to stress in a physiological way that can be very damaging.
And what can we do to attenuate that? Meditate? Run?
Well, there are all of those things, meditation. But one of the biggest things we can do actually is exercise. So it's more than just burning calories. Exercise also helps release all of those hormones. When we are being yelled at by our boss and we sit there and we want to attack him, we can't do that. That's socially inappropriate. So we instead, we listen to him and we calmly say, thank you very much for your feedback. And he walks out of the room and we are steaming inside. Well, our body is responding with a stress response, but we can't, you know, like I said, we can't attack him. So those hormones are never put into motion. They instead just stay inside. So when we exercise, we're actually able to sort of clear our blood and clear our body of these hormones that instead would stay in our body and damage our blood vessels and our organs and affect our digestion. Exercise is a great way to sort of get your body back into an equilibrium and sort of a resting state.
When we're under this kind of prolonged stress, what kind of effect does it have on how we eat and what we eat?
Well, it actually can induce some of that late night eating, and it also can make you crave sugars and sweets too. So it does have an impact on the kind of foods that you want to have.
And then the foods that we actually eat, does it make the foods be digested in a particular way?
Absolutely. This is actually all part and parcel of metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome has to do with high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high triglycerides, and that adipose tissue that builds around our stomach, which is sort of the beer gut. And that fat that builds around on our stomachs is actually around our organs. So that's not good for us. And the reason that happens is because of this whole fight or flight physiological response. It sort of puts the fat in our stomach instead of, I guess, rationally processing our nutrients that are incoming.
So then, given that it does all this damage to us, why is it that we want to have that good scare? What do we get out of it physiologically?
Well, that's really interesting. And I think that that's kind of our modern way of dealing with a lion. We enjoy it for a lot of reasons. Even author Stephen King has been interviewed a lot about this, of why is it that we love to be scared? And I think part of it is that we want to be protective about our fear. We like to be scared, but we want to do it in a safe way. And Halloween, being one of my favorite holidays, is a great way to sort of safely experience the scare without being in real danger. And it ends up becoming sort of a pleasure response because the part of your brain that processes, is this a rational fear? And when it says no, even though your body is responding, then you can say, oh, funny, thanks for pulling that practical joke on me. Or, you know, I know that that guy with the saw is just part of the haunted house. It's not a real threat. Even though your heart is racing and you're freaking out, you can then rationally say, after your body has responded in this way, oh, that's not real. Wow, that was so fun. Let's go to the next room.
Jill Janes, a nutritionist and registered dietitian. She's known as the Rockstar Nutritionist. Learn more about her and her program at kcrw.com/goodfood. Halloween is next week. It's one of those times that we can get close to fear and to death. And of course, have another excuse to eat lots of candy. In fact, it's the kickoff of the winter season of overeating. There's so much lore about Halloween, I thought it would be a good idea to find out where it all came from. Let's do that next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Soon it will be time for little ghouls and goblins to take to the streets. But why? Why do we dress up at Halloween? And what's the deal with the pumpkins? And the idea of feeding the dead? It seems bizarre, but it's deeply rooted in many cultures. Linda Civitello, author and teacher, is fascinated by this intersection of culture and cuisine. We're going to have a little lesson about Halloween. Hi.
Hello, Evan. Every culture has to try to find some way to deal with the dead. I mean, we've got this fear of death. We've got fear of the dark. We've got fear of the devil. And it's a basic human terror that goes back to before fire. And in the Middle Ages, what you have is you have cities that are walled for protection. People who commit murders, the worst of the criminals, were buried out there.
Outside the walls.
Outside the walls, out in the countryside. And if they had gone astray in real life and tried to lead you astray, well, after death, they're certainly going to come back and try to do this again. And this evil is out there. And if you've got a marsh, a woods, something, or just fog in a strange way, it could be a ghost. It could be a spirit out there coming to haunt you. And one of the ways you can prevent that from happening is dress up like it. It'll think you're one of them. You know, the old purloined letter fit right in principle, hide in plain sight. So you can do that. And the idea, again, that if you don't honor the dead, they will come back to haunt you. So we do that one day a year, and we've pretty much lost the meaning of that. But going back to ancient Mesopotamia, they had a really beautiful celebration. The ritual of food, it comes from the Mesopotamian word that means to break and distribute or hand out. It's called kispu. Every month, when the moon was dark, they had a memorial service for the dead. You know, there was a meal. There was a memorial meal. You did your own family at your table, and the king did his rulers, the people who had preceded him, and the warriors who had fallen. But these people, literally, they said, just because your family members are dead doesn't mean they don't need to eat. They just don't need to eat as much. You know, and this is so beautiful because it shows that breaking bread transcends time. Some European countries do this too. You go out to the cemetery to be with them, to remember them.
And the actual word Halloween, take me through that.
It is in a form of English that we don't use much. Hallowed is the word holy. So holy and een, E-E-N, there should be a V in there, E-V-E-N, All Hallows Even, the holy evening. And the Catholic Church comes in here. And you see them as Catholicism spread throughout Europe in the Middle Ages. You can't just walk into a country or go up to a people and say, everything you know is wrong, and you're going to worship this now. So you bring them together. You combine the two. So the night before is the pagan festival, All Hallows Eve, and the day after is the holy day.
This pumpkin squash, now this is something from our hemisphere. This is American.
Oh, yes.
How did it get inserted into this whole Halloween sort of celebration?
It's the idea jack-o'-lantern is just a night watchman. In England, it was a turnip. It was the other big vegetable that you could hollow out and they, you put a candle in. So the Halloween myths had, you know, were the turnips. And then you got to America and, you know, it's the perfect thing, although some pumpkins get to be enormous. I mean, they weigh, you know, 200-300 pounds. And frankly, Evan, I'm a little scared of any vegetable that outweighs me. But
So this hollowing out and carving a face into it.
The face of a goblin, again, the myth. And of course, we can't do that in Southern California. You hollow out a pumpkin and carve it and you put it out on your porch and
it
10
melts.
Minutes later, it's mold and it collapses.
I always remember so many Halloweens where by the time Halloween came along, you could just take your finger and put it right through the squash.
Yeah.
With like bake outside.
And it's also connected to fertility, as is bobbing for apples, which we just think is, you know, an excuse to stick your face in a tub of water and get messy. But that was a fertility ritual in Ireland. It was like throwing the bouquet. So it was unmarried people, people of marriageable age. It wasn't little kids doing this. And the first person who bit into an apple was supposed to be the first one who got married, and it was connected to the ritual of the Roman goddess Pomona, who was the goddess of fruit trees, and then pumpkin pregnancy.
It's big a fecund pregnant, fruit.
Yes.
Or vegetable.
Yes, absolutely.
Linda Civitella is on the culinary faculty at the Art Institute of California and teaches at the California School of Culinary Arts. She's also the author of Cuisine and Culture, A History of Food and People. I'd really like to encourage you to sign up for the Good Food Weekly newsletter. Each week, we highlight the show, tell you about interesting things, and give you a recipe. Sign up at kcrw.com/newsletters. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Chaloner, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Thanks to Sienna Spencer and Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in again next week for another edition of Good Food.